we had found that with atlantal axial rotation to the right, that urinary incontinence was found to be more severe in those athletes that had that preference. And with atlantoaxial rotation to the left, they were more likely to have less severe urinary incontinence. And so it was almost like a scale at the atlantoaxial joint, your C1 on C2. And I found that very, very interesting.
Hi, Chloe. It's my pleasure to have you on Evidence Strong Show. If you could briefly introduce yourself.
Hi. So I am Chloe Nutt, previously Chloe Dublin, and I am a third-year osteopathic medical student at Kentucky College of Osteopathic Medicine. I have also been competing in powerlifting now for almost 11 years, and I've competed on national teams for the United States and even the U.S. Virgin Islands. Most recently, I was in Iceland for the Equipped World Powerlifting Championships with the IPF and got a silver medal there, and we'll be going to the World Games in China. So that's a little bit of my background and what I like to do.
Awesome. So you're passionate about powerlifting. We love it here. Yeah. I invited you because you authored a paper titled Urinary Incontinence in Elite Female Powerlifters Aged 20 to 30, Correlating Musculoskeletal Exam Data with Incontinence Severity Index and Survey Data. So the topic is urinary incontinence, and we need some kind of definition to start with so we are all on the same page.
Yes. So urinary incontinence is any time that there is leakage of urine when you are not trying to urinate. So it's basically what people would call peeing their pants for more of a relaxed definition of it. There are different types of urinary incontinence. And for the most part, we focused on stress urinary incontinence, as that's when someone is exerting themselves, or you can think of sneezing, coughing, bending, pushing, pulling. And in lifting, we see it a lot, or most frequently in deadlift. So that's our example for stress urinary incontinence. However, there is some overlap between stress urinary incontinence and urgency, or overactive bladder even. And urgency is basically when you just can't hold it long enough to get to the bathroom and you have some leakage then. And the reason that sometimes these can overlap is because of reflexes that we have in our body. And so if you say that this is your bladder and this is the pipe that runs out of your bladder, if you get a little bit of urine in here, sometimes the bladder takes that as, oh, we need to go to the bathroom, and it will contract. So in theory, yes, the majority of what we see in lifting is stress urinary incontinence, but there could also be some urgency or overactive bladder on top of that.
Awesome. So why this is important? Why this is important for powerlifters?
Yes. So this study is very important for powerlifters and especially female athletes because it is such a great outlet for both physical and mental health, in addition to preventative medicine for musculoskeletal health in the future. Weight-bearing exercise is the only thing that has been found to be preventative for osteoporosis in women and men. And so this is such a great sport for people to pick up, and it's something that can potentially have a lot of longevity for people and that they can continue to do for a long time.
Awesome. Thank you. What was the aim of your paper and how you decided to run the study?
Yeah. So the aim of my paper, there had been some papers done by Dr. Wickander, and you can see that she is cited in my paper a few times. And she did some really great research as far as collecting survey data and getting a nice baseline and seeing the impact of pregnancy and age on urinary incontinence in female lifters. However, I, and along with many other people in powerlifting, have noticed that very young athletes who have never been pregnant before have experienced this as well. And they are older, and so there's not really a whole lot of traditional background other than the fact that we lift really heavy things that would cause us to have problems with this. So I wanted to look into this a little bit more, and we aim to classify the severity of the lifter's incontinence and see if it correlated with any musculoskeletal findings, or see if any of the survey data that we collected could potentially impact or make people more likely to experience this or not.
Now, in terms of organizing the study, you wanted younger athletes, so between 20 and 30, and you did some kind of examination and you collected some survey data. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. So every athlete that was in my study was between the age of 20 and 30 years old. And based off of their best total squat, bench, and deadlift altogether, they were in the top 2% of their weight class in the world. All of the athletes that participated were in the United States. These people have never had children before and they hadn't had surgery within the past 6 months. They were not acutely injured.
You went to the national level competitions. You recruited the athletes. They were top level, national level athletes in the US. And then you did some kind of testing. So what
did you do? So we took these athletes and I did a full body musculoskeletal examination. And I worked together with my professors, who are two osteopathic doctors at my school, to make this examination very seamless and smooth, and they approved that the way that I was collecting the information was correct and good and within good standards. And so they signed me off on this, and then I went out and examined every single person to keep the examiner, myself, consistent, as that can help with, you know, any variation in physical examinations between different practitioners. And so I completed all of the musculoskeletal exams. And then once I was done with that, I had them fill out the incontinence severity index that is also in my paper. I did not develop this. Another individual developed this, and I was very grateful to be able to use it in my study. And then they also filled out the survey data that did take some questions from Wickander's study and some questions that we had made up on our own, just to kind of evaluate some things that she had looked for in the past. So all of my musculoskeletal exam was completed before they filled out any survey data, and I made no changes to my exam after the survey data was completed to keep me neutral.
Okay, would you be able to tell us roughly, because coaches may not be familiar how osteopathic treatment or assessment looks like, what were you looking for?
The entire exam took between 10 and 15 minutes, and I was basically evaluating for motion preferences of the body. So for example, to check the glenoaxial joint, what we do is we have the patient lay down or the subject lay down on their back. I'll lift their head up to at least 45 degrees and then you rotate their head back and forth. And usually there's a preference in terms of whether they want to go to the right or left. And I did this all the way down the spine. We went very into detail in terms of collecting this information and even did muscle preferences. So we evaluated internal and external rotators and even preferences for the pelvic floor. And so you can go to the greater trochanters of the femurs and then go just medial to that and just kind of see if there is a preference on one side or another for one to kind of push in a little bit more or be tighter. And so we really went in depth in terms of collecting information like that.
Awesome. That gives us some kind of idea. Now, in terms of the survey, what type of questions were they?
Yeah, I actually have some pulled up here just for reference. So the survey included, and the information that we collected in general, we got their age, their weight class, their height, BMI, the best total that they've ever recorded, which we had to know for them to even come into the study, the number of years they've been participating in resistance training, their average training day length, if they've had a history of pelvic floor examination in the past, their confidence and their ability to be able to contract their pelvic floor muscles, a history of an abdominal or pelvic surgery, a history of UTIs, if they're sexually active or not, and if they do any self-care practices to attempt to reduce their leakage that they have.
Okay. Incontinence Severity Index. Let's talk about that.
The Incontinence Severity Index was developed by someone named Sandvik. And so it's called the Sandvik Scale for Incontinence Severity Index. And it asks them just two questions. It's how often do you experience leakage and how much urine do you lose each time? And so the how often is less than a month, one or several times a month, one or several times a week, every day and or every night. And how much urine do you lose each time is only two options, a few drops or a little or more. And this was found to be a very effective way of classifying mild, moderate, severe urinary incontinence. And so we use this as the basis for the study.
How many people did you end up having? And maybe if there's anything special there was about these athletes, some details about that, and then the results of the study.
Okay. So there were 31 female participants in total, and there's not anything really remarkable about these individuals other than they're in the top 2% of their sport. But I wanted to really evaluate the top percent of these athletes. In one of the previous studies with Wickander, she had found that an increasing total was maybe correlated with incontinence severity. And so I wanted to really hone in on the people that were very, very top performers and are pushing a lot of weight. And within my study, I actually didn't find that there was a correlation. And even though these two things contradict themselves, if you think about it, we actually kind of took out that variable. So in the big picture, yes, it might actually correlate with severity of incontinence, but on the elite level, no one's going to have worse or better, you know, just within the elite population, if that makes sense. Within this elite population then, so what is dividing people between mild and severe incontinence within them? And based off of our results, I'll go ahead and go into that.
Yes.
We found the most interesting thing to me was, as I was going through this entire thing, I was not thinking in any particular area, you know, that there would be any kind of correlation. I was like, we're just going to collect this information. We're going to see what we see, because there hadn't been any hands-on data before. It was just all surveys. And so we had found that with atlantoaxial rotation to the right, that urinary incontinence was found to be more severe in those athletes that had that preference. And with atlantoaxial rotation to the left, they were more likely to have less severe urinary incontinence. And so it was almost like a scale at the atlantoaxial joint, your C1 on C2. And I found that very, very interesting. And so at first when I got my data back, I was like, oh, like, I wonder what that could be. I'm not really sure, but it is what we found. And as I started looking into this more and more, we actually found that other studies had found that on your vagus nerve, there are sympathetic efferent neurons, meaning that they are getting feedback. So I kind of threw a lot out there, so let's break this down a little bit.
Yes.
The vagus nerve and the sacral plexus are your two main parasympathetic systems of your body. And the rest of the nerve roots that come out of your spine are the sympathetic system. And so the sympathetic system is going to kind of ramp you up, and your parasympathetic systems are going to kind of be on the calmer side and are in charge of urination and defecation and sleep and slower heart rate, things like that. And so the vagus nerve, it goes to the celiac plexus, which helps to regulate your bowels and your pancreas and different digestive systems. And then the left vagus actually goes to your heart and helps to regulate your heart rate. So it's very interesting that they found sympathetic efferent neurons on the vagus nerve, because that means that they're actually getting a sympathetic feedback on the vagus nerve, which was classified as a parasympathetic only nerve. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm following now.
Okay. So this is very interesting, because it begs the point that maybe the vagus nerve has an impact on the sacral plexus, which the sacral plexus is what we focus on with especially fecal incontinence. There have been sacral nerve stimulators that we use for that. And there's also sacral nerve stimulators that we use for bladder incontinence as well. And so that's generally the area that we really focus on and we already know works. But it seems like our body is actually manifesting and showing us that there is a preference to the right at the atlantoaxial joint. And this is important because the vagus nerve runs really close there. And so it's a possibility maybe that this area, if you are rotated to the right there, then it could impinge on the vagus nerve and impact its ability to talk as efficiently with the sacral plexus. They have not analyzed whether or not this connection exists in humans, but they have evaluated it in rats. And they did find that with sacral nerve stimulation, that there was an increase in pancreatic polypeptide, which is under the vagus control. And they evaluated the heart rate and found that there was actually a feedback between the sacral nerves and the vagus nerve. So this is a very possible thing. And the sympathetic efferent nerves the sympathetic efferent feedback that they found on the vagus nerves, those were in humans. And so this is kind of something that is a new development in neurology in general, which is very, very exciting. And I was kind of happy to find it as a little hint in my study. I just had to go dig a little bit deeper. So that we think that that's a possibility of what could be happening and why this particular musculoskeletal abnormality or preference is manifesting in people with more severe urinary incontinence.
All right, so we need to pause here and let me bring back what I'm hearing and let's bring it back to powerlifting too. So you have found that athletes who had a preference to rotating their neck to the right. I'm obviously simplifying, so please bear with me. So athletes who had a preference to rotate to the right were more likely to have severe incontinence, report severe incontinence. And yeah, that may mean that the vagus nerve that goes on the right is, I'm guessing here, overstimulated, or the pathways, the efferent pathways, so the feedback it's collecting is maybe more with these athletes. And all this, I don't know what it means, but the vagus nerve then gives some feedback to sacral plexus that will influence how the pelvic floor works and in practice how urinary incontinence is presenting itself.
Yes. Yeah, that is our idea behind our findings and the current scientific research. Yes. With the bracing, is we actually did have findings that I didn't cover. I covered the most interesting one, the one that like stays in my head the most. But we also found that people who have severe urinary incontinence in this group, they were more likely to have non-physiologic sacral diagnoses. What this means is that they were more likely to have their sacrum oriented in a manner that is not consistent with the natural walking of the human body. So usually as you're walking, your sacrum will either rotate this way with your pelvis or rotate this way. Non-physiologic will happen in any way other than that. So sometimes it's extended back this way, sometimes it might be extended back this way, or sometimes it's even unilaterally flexed or extended. And these all were more likely to be found in people with more severe urinary incontinence. And I had really sat on this for quite some time and was trying to figure out what this meant. I talked to my advisor, my mentor, and I was like, I am just really trying to figure out what this, how this could happen, or, you know, what this could mean. And what I basically came down to was that we already know that the pelvic floor has such a big impact on urinary incontinence. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I was just with a urogynecologist for my OBGYN rotation, and I had the honor of being able to see a lot of these procedures that we do in reconstructing the pelvic floor and mid-urethral slings that they use for stress urinary incontinence, urethral bulking, all of these things. And there is no doubt that it absolutely plays a part in this, and that pelvic PT is a great resource and can provide a lot of improvement. And I honestly think that a lot of that can come from any trauma that we've had in the past, and that can cause those muscles to contract, or even just painful sexual intercourse experiences that females have had can cause certain muscles in that area to contract or remain contracted, and that can impact our continence as females. And so our pelvic floor PTs are great, great resources for this. But outside of that, on a more basic and more powerlifting related level, there is a lot of concern about people not bracing correctly or bracing in ways that might predispose them to having more incontinence, more severity of their incontinence. And I think that that non-physiologic sacral diagnosis really fits with that, because as we are, okay, I actually did this at a conference not too long ago, and we are in a dress today. So if you can imagine, as you have your belt on here, if you are belly breathing like you're supposed to into your belt and putting pressure here, you should have a little bit of a gap or a more of a predisposition to having at least some flexion in your sacrum if you're breathing up here. However, if you're breathing really, really far down in your pelvis, and just think about, like, if you try to focus all of that pressure down in your pelvis, you will be putting a lot of internal pressure and backwards force on your sacrum, predisposing it to sitting back, which would be one of those non-physiologic sacral diagnoses. And I think that that could be reflective of a reason why people could be having more severe urinary incontinence with this sacral finding.
So what I'm hearing is, one is the neural feedback loop between vagus and sacral plexus, and the other is some kind of misalignment or different alignment that physiological and sacral bone and the pelvis.
Yes, absolutely.
Awesome. Wow, this is very new.
Yes.
Where do we go from now, from here?
Ideally, I would love to hear about people trying to treat these dysfunctions if they have them. If you have very severe or even mild urinary incontinence and just trying to balance the adlanoaxial joint and get the adlanoaxial joint in more of an alignment that is less likely to potentially frustrate the vagus nerve on either side, I think that it's worth seeing if that would improve people's incontinence. I also think that evaluating any dysfunctions in the body per individual could be useful in treating urinary incontinence, and especially with the focus at the adlanoaxial joint and the sacrum. But obviously, if you don't have one of these, like if you are not rotated to the right at your adlanoaxial joint, you know, like you're not going to benefit from the treatment from that if you're, you know, bit rotated to the left. And so that's why there need to be practitioners involved in this. More general recommendations, of course, are trying to avoid bladder irritants, and they're going to be different for everyone. But if you notice that you always have a certain food or something like that that irritates your bladder, and this is for across the board, then just trying to plan your day based off of that. You know, if you always know that, oh, whenever I have grapes and go to the gym, like I experience this problem more, then just, you know, you might choose not to have so many grapes before you go to the gym, and you can save them for another time. But common bladder irritants, especially for people that are powerlifters, are caffeine and carbonated beverages, which classically many people will have pre-workout that involve one or both of these things. And so I would play with that a little bit and see if that doesn't help with any incontinence problems that people have up front. And outside of that, I would go see your OBGYN and get a referral to a urogynecologist or a pelvic floor PT and start from there and work from there. As far as things that you can work on with your coach, if you're really having a lot of trouble with urinary incontinence, I would go to someone that you trust who would be able to teach you how to brace very well and ensure that you are doing that well. That is something that you can potentially go through with your physical therapist, but I wouldn't trust just like any other sport, right? Like I'm not going to expect every physical therapist to know how to brace in powerlifting because they don't all do powerlifting. So if you can find someone that you trust to evaluate this on you, I think that that's a great resource also and something to try.
Awesome. So the message is there are options if you are an athlete who experiences urinary incontinence or you are a coach who has an athlete with this problem. There are options that you can play with and check out and try to alleviate the symptoms. So it's not like it's permanent. It may be, but there is a lot of steps we can take to minimize or even get rid of this problem.
Absolutely. And as active people, obviously, we wouldn't want to go to a procedure from the jump for something like this, especially when there's a lot of things that we can do on the front end to evaluate. But if you are experiencing these symptoms when you're even running or doing any other activities, then I think it's something that you might be able to discuss with your urogynecologist and see if you are a candidate for a procedure in this area. If you're only experiencing it with heavy lifting, I don't know whether they would consider a procedure and just because it's very provoked by a lot of weight, you know. But there are different things that you can try. And actually, recently, I have learned about, there is something that I think it's called, bear with me here, it's called Impressa. And sometimes whenever people are having stress urinary incontinence, they'll put something called a pessary in. And this pessary is, it's not any kind of procedure. It's just a device that you can place in the vagina, and it will keep your urethra from moving when you do physical activity. And in doing that, it prevents the leakage or decreases it. And this is something that you can take in and out just like a tampon. But there's also a version of this that you don't have to go to the store for. Or you don't have to, that you do go to the store instead of your doctor. And it is called the Impressa. It's by Poise, but it kind of fans out and provides a support that is similar to a pessary, but it's much more temporary. And you can just place it in whenever you do physical activity and take it out immediately after that. And so that's a really good option as well, or something that could be something to try.
Awesome. Thank you.
I also wanted to say that our survey results, we had a positive relationship. So meaning that with more severe urinary incontinence and an increase in this variable, they were going in the same direction. That's a positive relationship. There was only a moderate strength relationship between age, history of pelvic floor examination, and engaging in leakage prevention practices with incontinence severity index. And all of the other variables did not have any correlation or any strength relationship that was worth noting with incontinence severity. And when I look at those variables and think of history of pelvic floor examination and engaging in leakage prevention practices, well, I probably could have told you that those people, if they have gone to get an evaluation for their pelvic floor, then they've probably already experienced this issue. And if they're engaging in leakage prevention practices, then they probably have pretty severe urinary incontinence as well. So those two things, I didn't really jump out to me because that wasn't very much of a surprise to me. But what I do think is notable is that this low level association between age, so from 20 to 30 years old, yes, there was a little bit of an association, but it was a moderate level association. It wasn't a high level association. So it's not like the people that were 20 years old had the lower level of incontinence and the people that were 30, like as soon as they hit 30, they're, you know, have incontinence very bad. That wasn't what we found. This was a very, very low level, moderate strength relationship with age and incontinence severity. So I don't think that for people who are lifting from 20 to 30 years old at just in that 10-year time frame, I don't think that powerlifting is the cause of them having a more severe urinary incontinence.
Good news.
That is good news. Especially what we want. I want more people in this sport, and it is a great sport to be a part of. So that's a good thing.
Awesome. Okay. Two short questions to finish. The first one is, what is your favorite lift and why?
Okay. Well, my favorite lift currently used to be my least favorite lift. So a lot of things have changed. But my now favorite lift is squat. And I don't know why. I guess it's just, it clicked with me at some point in time. I've had a lot of gains on it here in the recent times. And so I've just really enjoyed it. Bench has classically been my favorite. And I still do love bench, but squat has just been my favorite lately.
I see. All right. And where people can find you if they want to contact you or follow your work, get all the
news. So this study is published in DigRooter, and it is through the Journal of Osteopathic Medicine. Are you able to tag this in the...
Yes, I will put the link to the paper. Yeah.
Sweet. Thank you so much. So you can find the link in the bio of this channel. Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Student Dr. Nutt, or you can email me Chloe Nutt, KLOIENUTT at upike.edu with any questions. I would love to chat with you about this paper. I also want to give a little disclaimer. Anything that we talked about today is not medical advice. I am currently still a medical student, but this has all been evaluated with the information provided in my paper has been evaluated with doctors of osteopathic medicine. And we have a lot of good information in there. So I hope you guys got a lot out of this.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.